netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. If you listened to the last podcast, it was our NAB Roundtable from NAB 2010, our annual chance to kind of just sit around and talk about what we saw at NAB. Hopefully you enjoyed that, and we also picked up quite a bit of other content from NAB this year, as always. NAB is always a great show for us, content-wise. But we also, Jason Wingrove came over with us, who's the co-host of the Red Center podcast. So there's a very elaborate Red Center podcast from the show with Jason and Mike. We also recorded three FX Guide TV episodes that we've put out already from NAB. So if you haven't checked those out, you might want to check them out over on the site or on iTunes. And we also gathered some stuff that we will bring out over the next couple episodes, including stuff from the Foundry booth, those great kind of in-depth Nuke demos that you've seen us do before that we'd love to bring you. So keep your eyes open for those. The week before NAB, Mike Seymour and I got a chance to run around Los Angeles and get more content, like the podcast today, as well as classes for the current term at FX PhD. It was really great. We got to spend about an hour just sitting and talking in-depth HDR with Paul Dubevic. That'll be part of the background fundamentals on HDRs this term at FX PhD. So it's just a treat to be able to get out and talk to people and see facilities like this one. Today's podcast, we're going to talk to the people at Scoundrel FX. Back in March, Mike Seymour talked with Peter Webb and Paul Buckley from Allura. If you want to check that out in FX Guide TV episode 77 about their work on The Pacific, which is just an amazing HBO series. If you haven't seen it yet, it's truly one of those landmark, amazing series, just really in-depth, really historically trying to be accurate. Beautiful work. Anyway, besides Allura, there was a company named Scoundrel FX that did over 600 shots in the show. So it was a great day in Los Angeles. We drove around to their office, which is classic Los Angeles story. I drive by this place frequently through the week and have never known that there was a visual effects company in there. So classic Los Angeles. There's people everywhere doing this work. Anyway, we got to sit down and talk to three people from Scoundrel: Marco Rokai, the visual effects supervisor, Morgan McDermott, the 3D supervisor, and Nick Lendalrich, comp supervisor. Mike starts off talking to Marco.
So thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So give us some idea of the scope of the work that you did on Pacific.
Pacific is really one of the largest projects we've ever taken on. So we kind of covered an entire range of things. It's a 10-episode miniseries, and we did 600 shots over 7 of those episodes. So it was definitely the entire spectrum from composites, 3D vehicles, matte paintings, lots of set extensions, things like that.
So just to get the set of technical parameters, presumably the show was being produced HD for the final output, but shot at film?
Yeah, it was shot in 2K, full app, and then they obviously extracted to 1920.
So the film, the program, sorry, is incredibly visceral and also really, really authentic in the sense that the story is incredible. Well known, there are people that are alive that were obviously familiar with the events, and of course the entire world knows of what happened. There must have been a certain ownership on you to deliver really authentic visual effects that had a realism to them.
Yeah, it definitely was, and it was something that was stressed from the very beginning of the project, from production to the supervisors. Everyone down the line was really looking to make that as realistic a view as we could of this event and this, you know, what these men went through in the Pacific War. Things like trying to get the right vehicles, trying to get the right effects for each weapon, you know, sound effects. Everyone was really working to get that realism on screen.
So what did you do in terms of research for the project? Like, how did you go about approaching it to get that accuracy?
Well, a lot of the research was actually done for us. They had a great, you know, historian team that would give us just these packets and books and things to go through and look at. But on top of that, we would do research looking at the Navy records. There's a lot of stuff in the Navy for, like, the invasion on Iwo Jima. There's photos and descriptions and interviews with people, because you know, they record all that just for historical record. So there's a lot of that stuff available that we could go through.
And so when you approached the project, was it because of the nature of it being, in a sense, a sequel to Band of Brothers, was there a really healthy timeline for you to work on it, as opposed to many productions these days, which tend to be sort of super rushed?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a blessing and a curse. The entire project spanned 2 years almost exactly. We began in October 2007, getting some of our first plates, and then we delivered our final shot in October of 2009. So the timeline was definitely extended, but the amount of work that we had to do over that period was, you know, definitely also pretty intensive.
And in terms of asset generation, was it because obviously it's multiple episodes, it's the same period of time but different military situations. Was there an asset generation phase followed by the implementation, or was it really because of the Ranger being down in Melbourne and Iwo Jima, and that was a lot of sort of as you went along?
Yeah, the one of the tricks that we found was sort of a hassle throughout the show was that they kept changing the equipment as the war went on. They upgraded the planes, began, you know, with Wildcats and Guadalcanal, Hellcats, and then later on they're using the Corsair planes. So you kind of had to keep upgrading our equipment along with the story. So we didn't quite have a chance to build everything at once and let go. It was with each of these episodes going, you know, in concurrent production, we had to keep building things and throwing them in there.
So what was the pipeline? What was the sort of tools of choice for the company?
Well, we were using Maya for all of our animation and rendering and things like that, Mental Ray on the rendering side.
And any specific tools for any of the effects type animation work or explosions? Obviously quite a lot of flames and fire and smoke and stuff.
Actually, luckily, most of that stuff was shot. They just did hundreds and hundreds of on-set explosions. I think they had an enormous budget of fuel burning. I think it was something like $60,000 a day in fuel burning.
Wow.
Just for production. So we had just a tremendous library of explosions, bullet hits, you know, brain matter, goo, everything going on.
So what was then the composite pipeline for?
The compositing pipeline was done mostly in Shake with a little bit of After Effects. We had about 15 compositors working on the show, and those guys were really trying to get the timing and the location of the explosions and things set up first. So we'd go through the first pass, kind of working with the director and the producer to set up what they wanted things to look like, how much stuff was going on screen, and then we'd refine those, putting in the proper, you know, technical, this is a M1 muzzle flash, this is a carbine muzzle flash, things like that, kind of refining those composites as time went on.
And so on set, were you provided with a lot of green screen elements, or was it a lot of roto work? And if you were provided with those green screens, was there a lot of foreground smoke and dust and stuff to deal with?
For the muzzle flashes, those were all shot blue screen, dust hits, things like that worked really well on the blue screens, pulled really cleanly, everything worked great. The thing that was really the difficult part was, you know, when you've got a giant, you know, piece of artillery hitting, they couldn't just put a blue screen behind, you know, a 10-story explosion. So those were shot against blue skies, and we found that there were quite a bit more clouds in Australia than we would care for. So there's a lot of work in rotoing and paint and stuff to kind of clean those elements up, and there were some really great ones that we just had to let go because they wouldn't pull, so...
Was the relationship that there was an effects editor with the production that was pulling those, or was it more like you just got all the material they shot and then you were doing your own effects editing to decide what explosion would fit in what sort of space?
We did have a great effects editor, and he would work with us kind of, he had the entire library of everything they shot, and we would kind of work with him to pare that down, and then we'd get a, you know, just a truckload of stuff on our doorstep and pick through those to really see which ones worked out best in the shots.
So, Morgan, if we can switch to you now and have a look at an individual shot, which we'll put up on the webpage at FX Guide. And this is a great shot, I think, to look at. It's a shot, we can just describe it for people that are listening but haven't maybe seen it on the site yet.
Yeah, this is when the Americans invade Iwo Jima. It's a little bit after the initial invasion, because when they first came ashore, there was no response from the Japanese, and the Japanese let the Americans sort of pile up on shore, and it got really crowded. And once there was sort of this big mess on shore, the Japanese let loose with artillery and everything. And this scene takes place after the Japanese have started attacking.
And it's a really good shot to look at, just to drill down, which we love to do, because you've got, in a plate photography sense, you've got what, just basically some dirt and some guys?
Yeah, they basically just dug a ditch to represent the beach, and we added pretty much everything else.
And that everything else includes the rest of the beach, of course, the famous rock mountains, I guess, to the left.
Sarabachi. Hills,
and then the ocean behind, of course, and the waves coming in. So talk us through the laser net, starting with that background. Was that... Obviously, it had to be a digital environment because of the nature of the shot.
Yeah, so we created two separate large map paintings for this one, which was Sarabachi, which we just handled as a separate element and layered all of the artillery hits and smoke on top of. And then we created one large map painting that included the water and the sand. And I had elements of water that I used looping on
them. All right, I was going to ask you that. So that's actually a live action plate as opposed to like a sprite or simulation.
Yeah, they shot a lot of water that I, you know, stretched to its max to
right. And then of course at this point it's very denuded of any kind of military equipment. I guess the next stage was to add in what must have been an incredible amount of military hardware.
Yeah, we did a lot of research to look into exactly how many ships were there and how many of certain kinds and where they were, how far from the beach and all of that. And what we ended up putting into the Miocene is pretty close to what was actually there. Because of the large pan on the shot, we had to put in pretty much everything that was there to fill up the whole space. So it ended up being a ton of geometry to deal with.
Because of the strong atmospherics of the real event, there's a huge amount of depth cueing in this shot as things go back. Was a lot of that built into the shaders, or was it just part of the comp? In other words, what did you deliver from 3D to comp?
It was mostly done in comp. The stuff that I delivered from 3D didn't have environment fog or anything in it, though I did deliver everything in layers, so each, you know, successive layer back could be comped separately.
And for each individual layer, was it a multi-pass solution, or were you basically trying to nail it in the shaders and the pass so that it didn't need to be so separately tweaked on ambient occlusion or whatever?
No, we did separate passes. We did less for the further away pieces than we did for the up-close hero pieces, but definitely separate passes.
So on one of these foreground landing vehicles, or what I'm going to call a tank, and you're going to correct me as to what that actually was.
LVT.
Do you find that you've now become far more of an expert in military equipment than you ever expected to?
Absolutely.
So on that, anyway, what would be, on a foreground element, what would be the typical passes from 3D that the guys would use?
We would do color, diffuse, spec, ambient occlusion, and usually a couple different specs to sort of layer the lighting. We rendered everything with physical sky and mental ray. So a lot of the lighting that we would have had to tweak, like in comp or with separate lights, was just given to us because we were outside.
Now, of course, there's going to be a lot of gunfire and cannon fire and stuff going on. What about the contact lighting on that, so 3D environment elements?
Because the scene is so buried in so much smoke, we didn't have to get too detailed with that.
Okay.
With the practical elements that we layered in, it sort of added itself.
And so there is a lot of that smoke elements. Was that stuff that we were hearing earlier that was shot live action, or is this CG?
It's all live action.
And so that was just keyed off blue?
Yeah, off of sky, pretty much.
And in shake?
Yeah, and After Effects.
Right. And so then that layers up very well. Of course, there's some camera moves and stuff going on. Generally speaking, what was your camera tracking solution for the stuff that you're doing on the program?
We use PF Track and Synthize, too. We had a dedicated tracker
and
did
you,
all the tracking for the show.
Presumably you had like all the lenses and distortion charts and stuff, or were you working blind?
No, working blind. Yeah, okay. A lot of guesswork going on there.
Quite a few wide-angle shots in the show from having enjoyed the episodes that have already gone out.
Yeah, yeah.
Bit of distortion and
it would have been very helpful to have some more specific detail.
And then in terms of what you're delivering once you've done the final comp, how close were you getting in terms of the grade? Because it's not really viable for you to pass grade past elements in terms of mats and stuff to the grading department. Did you have to try and get a rough grade happening for delivery, or were they being extensively graded and you were just using a viewing LUT?
We were mostly just using a LUT with an idea of what the final color was going to look like. What it ultimately ended up in the show is a much more contrasty, intense version than we were working with at the time. So it's gone pretty far from where we started.
Right, to get that sort of crushed blacks and kind of gritty feel of the... and in terms of the camera shutters and stuff, I was wondering whether there was any reduced shutter stuff going on, because there seemed to be in some of the sequences that they'd got reduced shutter, and so there must have been some motion blur issues to try and match in accordingly to the live action.
And we didn't run into too many problems with that, really. You know, we didn't have a lot of situations where the motion blur was so mixed in with the shot that it had to be so perfect that it became an issue.
So I guess the $24,000 question I always like asking people this, actually, is knowing what you know now, given such the huge volume of work, would you approach anything differently?
I think that we ran into some problems with the geometry. Our original geometry was kind of heavy, and we had to go backwards and make it lighter. We didn't anticipate having so much. I ended up using mental ray reference objects in the scene, which I would totally use again. I learned a lot about referencing objects into Maya and having everything in separate reference files that I learned a lot of tricks about that, you know, you have to be really careful of, that I would be more exacting starting from scratch.
Any examples you want to?
A lot of the references just lose their connection to what they are, and the namespace has to be correct. So it's a lot of tiny little gotchas that came to bite me eventually.
In the shot, as I'm sure in many others, you're matching CG elements to actual live elements that were there, not talking about now the soldiers, but their equipment. Were there HDRs and stuff taken on set, and was anything like that provided? Were you just eye matching for lighting?
Yeah, pretty much just eye matching.
Yeah. Excellent. So let's change gears now, and Nick, we're going to maybe look at one of the other shots you guys did.
Before we move on, I just want to point out that one of the best compliments we had was that one of the producers asked us to move one of the tanks, but that tank was actually one of the practicals on set. So it was that was a great compliment that that our stuff looked just identical to the
right.
real ones.
Did you have to move it anywhere?
No, actually, we were lucky for that.
So let's go on to a shot from episode 6. Again, we'll put this on the website so people can have a look at it in some detail. But it's another really good shot, and a particularly interesting point in the show, because certainly from reading the books, this is a really, I guess, less featured battle than some of the other ones that people might know, but really a horrendous environment for the guys that actually had to go through this in real life.
Before we started, I honestly hadn't even heard of Peleliu. And it turns out it was one of the largest conflicts in all of World War II. And one of the main things we did for Peleliu was put in the Umbrogel Mountains, which is a mountain chain of just razor-sharp coral rocks. And they're featured really prominently in the background as the Marines advance onto Peleliu. But then they have to, throughout episodes 6 and 7, they have to advance into the Umbrogels and take the positions.
Which is, I think, a really important point, because obviously crossing the airfield and stuff in the foreground, but the actual elements that you were dealing with were of absolute plot significance, because it wasn't as if this is just background mountains you're sticking in for any good old reason. These are actually strategically incredibly important to what's happening at this point in the story.
Right. We had countless photographs to try and match the mountains exactly. We had layouts of the islands of where, which hills were where, and the hills were even, you know, specific hills where specific conflicts took place. We made sure to try to get all those in there. The production shot in an area where the hills were similar in location to the real Umbrogels, but we had to then make them look like the jagged rock that they actually were.
Yeah, it's not enough when you've got something that's so significant and so vivid, I guess, to just get something that looks kind of close, because really the producers at every level seem to have gone for a level of authenticity that, I guess, was paying respect to those that actually deal with it. So how did you go about doing that? Was it a 3D construction of the, or was it enough to do a matte painting?
The mountains were done as a matte painting, as a 2D matte painting. Just to make it easier and to try to get the placement exact, we did use the 3D track and place the 2D elements in 3D to make sure they're just the placement and the spacing between them was correct enough.
So were you working off real world scale? Had you got some kind of measurements of the
We placed them in real world scale, and then on a shot by shot basis, we had to sort of, based on the camera lens and what you could see, we sort of move things around in 3D space, never changing where things actually were, but just to get it right in the 3D scale, we massage that to get that
it's
correct.
An interesting problem, isn't it? Because in many respects, you're not making a documentary, but you've got the sort of weight of history to get right at the same time.
Right. The images were key in sort of matching everything, because really, I mean, I saw some still photographs of World War II of the Umbrogels the other day, and I was like, wow, we really, our stuff looks just like that. And it was really cool to see, because...
So now let's discuss this, because at this point in the story where they are, there's a lot, and I mean a lot, of very thin vertical kind of branches and broken burnt things. And I'm suspecting that you didn't have vast 20 kilometers of green screen.
No, there was no green screen in the shot. There's a number of these extremely wide shots, camera moving the whole time. And we had a number of these, and we had to roto all the branches. Where they went into the sky, we could key them, but... a lot of the times it's just a lot of roto.
Yeah, I mean, there's really no keying opportunity when you've got sort of dusty gray things over dusty gray stuff and three-dimensional camera moves. So tell me, what was the approach to the roto? Like, was it what tools were you using?
Silhouette was used primarily for the roto. It's really fast to turn this kind of stuff around, but really all hands on deck, and we used Shake After Effects, you know, to sort of mix and match roto from time to time when when things were missing with the roto. We just sometimes just had to quickly go in whatever package we were comping in and just quickly do some more roto if something was missed in the main pass.
Did you have any photographic reference of this stuff, or was it literally just using what was provided in the plate?
Photographic reference for what the mountains look like?
No. For anything in the mid-ground, was that all just from what was on set?
It was all from what was on set.
Because I would have been tempted to remove stuff and then just put it back. And
yeah, I mean, there was occasionally some of these big shots had foreground explosions, and if they cut off, we would just layer them up with more elements so we didn't have to roto the smoke.
And then in this shot that we're looking at, there is some interesting mid-ground destruction, presumably some kind of structure that was to do with the airfield. Was that in the plate photography, or was that added?
Yeah, they built extensive sets recreating the period exactly. I mean, we've seen pictures where the power station and the administration building, I mean, they're identical to the real ones. So we didn't have to build, we didn't have to put the buildings, we were just doing the hills behind.
And because there was so much naturally hazardous kind of explosions and stuff going on, were there any safety lines or safety stuff that had to be painted out? In other words, did you have to clean up the plates a lot, or was it pretty much, from the camera's point of view, well-dressed for...
Occasionally, we had to remove the covers to the mortar pots, but they did a really good job of hiding everything and covering everything up. There was a lot of removal, but nothing you know, out of the ordinary for a show of this size.
So, getting back to your mountains, then, which obviously were you had a great reference. I imagine none of that reference was at a resolution that was good enough for you to sort of specifically use.
No, a lot of the reference pictures were small resolution. I mean, we could scan them larger, but it was mostly just for visual reference.
So how did you actually go about doing it? Was it literally just painting stuff up in Photoshop and then layering it up, or?
Yeah, the map paintings were painted from scratch in Photoshop.
And what kind of res were you doing that at?
I think the final painting was done at 24K. It was an immense painting because there's lots of different angles of almost a 360 degree angle of the mountains, and we needed to be able to cover them at every point.
Oh, so it was a master matte painting rather than a series of smaller ones.
Right. It was a master matte painting, and then each individual compositor could go into the painting and pull what he or she needed to cover the hills in their specific shot.
Right. And then, of course, there's being a battle. There's aircraft and stuff going on. And was that all then presumably added as CG?
Or? Right. In a number of shots, we added CGI planes flying overhead. And at that point, they were bombing the hills. And I think they might have stopped as they were crossing the airfield, but there's a lot of shots, especially right before they start the cross of the airfield, where there's planes flying overhead.
Now, moving away from this shot in particular, but obviously in the nature of the program, there is quite a lot of people that actually get shot, get even legs blown off and stuff like that. Did you guys have any work with having to sort of do removal of limbs, or just adding in kind of...
We didn't do too many removals of limbs, but we added an awful lot of limbs flying around.
Oh, really? And sort of body parts, kind of debris on the...
Right. We added, I mean, more blood hits than we could count, but we did a number of CGI arms and legs and heads, body parts flying around due to massive trauma from explosions. And
I mean, it's one of the nastiest aspects about the whole thing, which is the sheer waste of human life, and that's just an enormous number of people got killed in this.
I mean, they shot an awful lot of really, really bloody stuff, and we sort of just came in to enhance certain shots and just make them that much more gory.
So on this sequence, getting back to the airfield kind of stuff, give me a rundown on how that would run through the process. I mean, how long would you kind of basically have for it here, and then how long would it take to get it iteratively cycled through the, let's face it, rather well-known producers on this film?
We got the shots, and we did temp versions where we placed the mountains where we thought they would be, and then we turned those over to sort of get approval on the mountains, And that it was usually not a problem to get by off of once we sort of decided the scale for all the shots, because once we had that scale, it was really easy to place all the mountains in, and we had reference for every single shot of exactly where the mountains were based on the actual geography.
Was there some kind of military or historical advisor that was kind of checking anything, or was it just really just the production company's research?
They did have a historical advisor. We got notes not always based on specifically who they came from, so we would get the notes, and sometimes they're from the producer, sometimes they're from the historical advisor.
And then presumably that was a long time before this would go to air. Did stuff get revisited through the grade or anything else like that?
We went back once to revisit some of the shots when we wanted to change sort of the scale of the mountains. This wasn't towards the end. It was sort of in the middle of the process, but we had to revisit and sort of change the scale. But we'd only done episode 5 at that point, and the majority of mountain shots were 6 and 7. So,
well, thanks for that. I've got to say, Marco, you guys seem to me sounding like this wasn't that hard, but it looks bloody hard. It's like I think you're not doing necessarily yourself a great.
Yeah, I think because we worked on it for so long, and now we've had 6 months to kind of
like a holiday
to unwind from the horrors of World War II. But it really was a challenging show in a lot of aspects. I mean, just the fact that the way they wanted to portray the war, so you're in there in the trenches with the guys, you're running along and feeling the horror of war around you, so that camera's always moving.
Yeah, it's not a locked off camera.
Yeah, you're always tracking that camera. You're always rotoing out branches and smoke and things that are just flowing through all the shots. So there's definitely tons and tons of work just to get to the point where you can add what you need to do.
Well, plus the tracking. I mean, there are things at night, but there are also things in smoke and dust, and hardly good tracking points for.
Yeah, there was a lot of debate between the tracking guys and the compositing guys trying to get just exactly what they needed, and it was definitely long hours and lots of revisions to get everything locked down.
Actually, did you enhance any of that camera stuff? I mean, you were making shakes and shutters and sort of redoing any removes, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of retiming done, actually. They originally had wanted to do a little more slow motion things in certain areas, and then somewhere about midway in the project, the direction changed, and they didn't want to do a whole lot of that stuff. They wanted to stay realistic and, just in camera the whole time. So there's a lot of slow motions that were changed. They always use that slower shutter angle. I think it's a 45-degree shutter. So that kind of made things a little unique in terms of the motion blur. So some changes there that were interesting.
So I asked this question before, but I didn't ask it of you. Looking back now from your position, is there anything you'd do differently? Was there anything that you think that... because it's a huge amount of shots, 600 shots.
I don't know that I would do anything differently. I think, coming at it again, I'd feel a little less freaked out by the amount of work we had to tackle over the whole project. But really, I'd like people to really kind of feel what's going on screen. It's kind of hard to explain just in the when you're watching the show, you don't really realize all the things that are on screen are there for a very specific reason. So a lot of people see explosions going on in hills and bombings going on over the beaches, and it's kind of tough to show
because they're not arbitrary choices.
Yeah, we didn't make those choices randomly. They were actually historically based. So if you watch like the invasion of Iwo Jima, there's artillery bombing going on in the hills, but when you see a plane go by, that artillery has to stop. So there's actually these timing windows where the Navy would be on a clock and they would say, we're bombing for the next 30 seconds, cut the artillery, and then the planes would fly through. And so there's a lot of sort of choreography that goes on behind all these shots that, when you're watching the show, you don't realize, but it's really kind of all really worked into this whole tableau.
Yeah, I think the overall reward you get from having that level of attention to detail is that, and it's a bit like, I guess, doing a model, where you do vast amounts of modeling detail of high-frequency stuff, that it does ring true because that just all adds to the sort of gravitas of the production and just gives it that authenticity that makes it such a great show. And I've got to say, congratulations, because I think it is a really top show.
Thank you.
And thanks for talking to us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great being here.
Well, thanks, guys. As I mentioned before, if you haven't checked out the series, the Pacific on HBO, I really can't recommend it highly enough. Great work by all the people that did visual effects work on this show. So that'll do it for this FX podcast. Until next time, for my partners Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser.
please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.